I think we were all dreading that question. This was as rural and white as any county in the Midwest. Not Democratic territory in general, and if it was going to favor any Democrat at all, it would be John Edwards of North Carolina. Still, he had asked, and we weren't about to lie. After a moment studying our shoes, one of us finally coughed up that we were knocking on doors for Senator Obama. Well, he paused. He's my second choice. Turns out Farmer Dauten was a Bill Richardson man. In a way, my military career started that week, with my friends Ryan and Nathaniel knocking on doors and canvassing local Dairy Queens in three of the lowest-income counties in the state of Iowa, Ringgold, Decatur, and Union. Immersed in my business career at McKinsey, but feeling like I couldn't just sit out the 2008 presidential campaign without being involved in some way, I had decided to take a little time off in January to do something to help the campaign of Barack Obama, who was still considered unlikely to overtake the juggernaut of Hillary Clinton, but was showing increasing strength. I'd become aware of Obama when I was a senior in college and he was running for Senate in 2004. Someone sent around a video clip of him speaking in a church, and it sounded different from any political rhetoric I'd heard before. If there's a child on the south side of Chicago that can't read, that makes a difference in my life, even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen on the west side of Chicago who can't afford her prescription medicine, that makes my life poorer, even if it's not my grandparent. Inspired yet analytical, he seemed a welcome alternative to the bravado of President Bush. And yet, unlike most running for Congress or Senate that year, he was able to campaign with very little reference to the Republican side at all. Importantly, he had also opposed the Iraq War, at a time when most Democrats were afraid to say what they truly believed. I started following his campaign, and as a graduating senior, briefly entertained a job offer from his race for Senate before deciding to go to Arizona instead for the Kerry campaign. My reasoning, idealistic if not the most career savvy, was that Obama was highly likely to win his race in Illinois anyway, and so I could make more of a difference in a battleground state on the presidential effort. It was there, on a 13-inch tube TV in my office cubicle in Phoenix, that I watched the convention keynote speech that made Obama famous. By 2008, it was clear to me that this candidate was not like the others, and worth supporting for the presidency. Many of my friends felt the same way, and three of us decided to reach out to the campaign to see if we could be helpful by taking a few days off to knock on doors. As a result, our trio spent the days around New Year's 2008 in South Central Iowa, working in towns not very different from the small communities I knew in rural areas around South Bend. One thing I hadn't expected was how big a role the Iraq War was playing in these one stoplight towns with grain elevators for a skyline. Not as a political football, but as a kind of local issue. The Iraq troop surge was winding down, but not yet over. Afghanistan, mostly out of view, was simmering. Yellow ribbons were everywhere, and more than once, I would knock on a door and get into a conversation with a young man who told me he would love to go to the caucus on Thursday and vote, but couldn't because he was packing up for basic training. In fact, it seemed like every other teenager I met was signing up for the Army or the Guard. I was only 25 years old, but these freckled young Iowan recruits looked like children to me. And I began asking myself how it could be that whole communities in this part of the country, just like those in rural Indiana, seemed to be emptying out their youth into the armed services, while so few people I knew had served at all. Warming up in a diner after a day's canvassing, Ryan and Nat and I tried to construct a list of people we'd known at Harvard who had gone into the military. You could count them on one hand. It wasn't just us, and it wasn't just Harvard. In their book, AWOL, The Unexcused Absence of America's Upper Classes from Military Service and How It Hurts Our Country, Kathy Roth Duquet and Frank Schaefer examined the record and found that the Ivy League college with the most 2004 graduates going to the military was Princeton, with all of 9 students going into service. Much had changed since the days when the names of over 100 Harvard men made their way onto the wall in the transept of Memorial Hall. Some combination of social stratification, Cold War campus politics, and changing norms around elite universities meant that service had gone from standard to rare. For my grandfather's generation, military service was a great equalizer, something that Americans, at least American men, had in common across race, class, and geography. Indeed, for some prior generations, the rate of loss in war may have been higher for the wealthy than for the working class, because service was so close to the heart of elite culture. There is nothing unusual about Lieutenant Junior Grade John F. Kennedy, scion of one of the most prominent and well-connected wealthy families in America, risking death aboard PT-109 in the South Pacific. The wealth and fame of JFK's father, Joseph Kennedy Sr., made it more, not less, natural that his sons would enter the service. Indeed, John F. Kennedy's path to the presidency was cleared only by the death of his older brother, Joe Jr., the one thought destined for high office until that naval airplane explosion in 1944. The entire campus of the elite prep school Phillips Andover was in uniform throughout World War I, so it was hardly shocking that the outbreak of World War II would motivate a young George Herbert Walker Bush to enlist on his 18th birthday and find his own way to the Pacific. A year after Kennedy and the men of PT-109 were rescued from the island where they had washed up, another Navy operation would rescue young Bush out of the waters of Chichijima, where he had been shot down during a daring strafing run. No less remarkable for men of such privilege was the fact that they would have been interacting on more or less equal terms with people from other walks of life, regions, and backgrounds. As an enlistee, Bush, whose father would soon be a senator, might have taken orders from the sons of farmers or laborers. Kennedy's fellow officers aboard PT-109 were from Ohio and Illinois. In 1956, a majority of the graduating classes of Stanford, Harvard, and Princeton joined the military. But in the decades that followed, the once diverse makeup of our military shifted dramatically. Especially after Vietnam, America saw a growing share of service members coming from places like Mount Air and Creston in Iowa, or Fulton County in Indiana, and far fewer from places like Harvard. The proportion of members of Congress who were veterans had fallen from 70% in 1969 to 25% in 2004, and fewer than 2% of members of Congress had a child who was serving. As I reflected on it, I realized that my arrival at Harvard coincided with the near disappearance of my own childhood interest in serving. At a younger age, when I had hoped to be an astronaut or a pilot, service in uniform was very much on the table. Indeed, on my mother's side, it was a family tradition. One of my heroes growing up was a relative I had never met, my great-uncle Russell Montgomery, an Army Air Corps captain who died in the 1941 plane crash. My grandmother's house had a large painting of him on the wall, in the house where she and my grandfather settled after he retired from the Army at Fort Bliss in El Paso. In the painting, Russell is seated, in uniform, his cap on one knee, a bookshelf behind him, and a painting of a dog on the wall over one shoulder. Beneath a generous brow, he gazes forward, with blue eyes that look commanding and serious, yet self-possessed and approachable. After my grandmother died, the painting found a new home on the wall of our South Bend living room. Since we weren't a paintings of ancestors on the wall kind of family, I once asked my mother how it came to exist. She explained that during World War II, my grandfather, still grieving the loss of his brother, encountered a German officer in a prisoner of war camp in New Mexico who knew how to paint. Even in war, there is a gentlemanly understanding between officers of different countries. Using two photographs, one of Russell and one of his favorite dog, the young German officer was able to create the portrait, which my grandfather bought from him. It was the only painting in our house that hadn't been painted by my grandfather himself or by my mother. Besides the painting, the family had another treasure of Russell's, his logbook. The tiny, leather-bound notebook contained a log of his flight hours, but also little anecdotes about the life of an officer and pilot in those still freewheeling days of early Army aviation. In it, he writes about hops across the Midwest to build up his flight hours, usually in the company of a fellow officer, and punctuated by football games and visits with girls. The entry for October 24, 1931, is characteristic. Flew to Pittsburgh, PA with Lieutenant McAllister in BT-2B. Through rain all the way but last 15 minutes. Left Dayton at 8 o'clock a.m., arrived Pittsburgh at 10:05. Met some wonderful people. Saw Purdue Wallop Carnegie Tech 13-6. Had lunch at UNIV Club. Went to dance at Athletic Club with a very good blind date. Saw lots of fraternity brothers. Flying time, 2 hours, 5 minutes. Flew back next day, October 25, to Dayton. An awful headwind and air was terribly rough. Was initiated into air sickness, an awful feeling. As far as we know, it was taken from his remains after the crash, and I used to thumb through it with wonder as a child, a family relic even more unique and special than the painting. the paragraph-long adventures were as engaging as a novel, but also may have added to my sense that military service, like war in general, belonged to a different time and place than my own. These traces from my personal and family history had faded as the adventures of Harvard, then Oxford, commanded my attention. The question, "Why aren't you wearing your country's uniform?" did sometimes nag at me, as I made, with the unique confidence of a college student, some lofty statement about public service or national security. But it always seemed like there was something else for me to focus on, and few of my peers were serving either. Most of the role models I would have had, military officers actually connected to me, were relatives who had died before I was even born. Back from Iowa and visiting my parents one day, I squared up to the painting and looked at it closely. I put myself in Russell's place. I must have been coming up on the age he had been when the original photo was taken. For him and his generation, a college education and a military career went hand in hand. For me, education had somehow made military service seem more remote. Yet all around me, especially in small towns and rural areas, men my age, and much younger, were making themselves available for the defense of our country. The more I reflected on it, the less it seemed I had any good excuse or reason not to serve. The first time I tugged on the door of a recruiting office, I found it closed. It was the first step toward realizing that getting into the military was not as simple as I'd have thought. Later, a recruiter who called back from the 1-800 number I had dialed passed me to a cheerful NCO in the local office in South Bend, who routed me toward a lieutenant from somewhere in Michigan who would go silent for days, then suddenly pepper me with calls and emails before going dark again. At one point, I learned that when I'd told them my college coursework in Arabic might make me a good intelligence officer, they had recorded that my minor at Harvard had been in aerobics. But the wheels of Big Navy did their slow work, one bubble test or triplicate form at a time, until one day an email directed me to check in at a Radisson in Des Plaines, Illinois, ahead of a physical exam at the Military Entrance Processing Station. Judging by the do's and don'ts in the email, the expectations seemed manageable. Take a shower, be clean. Also, no pants that shows exposed underwear. And body piercings must now be removable and the pierced area must be free of inflammation or infection. I could handle this. At 04:15 over breakfast in the suburban hotel, it was hard to miss the fact that the vast majority of people entering the military were more like the teenage recruits I had seen in Iowa than anyone I'd known in college. As conversation around me focused on which girls were the hottest and how various parents had reacted to the news, I began to wonder if I was the only one old enough to drink among this group of 70 or so, preparing to be herded onto the bus to MEPS. The sensation of being an object on an assembly line began at the top of the stairs leading to the intake room, as a woman ran what looked like a marker across my forehead, leaving a moist imprint that I later learned had something to do with testing for swine flu. Then we were separated by service, with Army people going to the Army room, and so on. I took my seat on one of the chairs in the Navy room, warily eyeing a poster on the wall that staff used to identify tattoos containing hate group symbols. A TV was playing some action movie which captivated most of the recruits around me. My name was called. A very large woman with gray hair and purple sweatpants took my fingerprint on a computer and presented me with a folder and some papers to take to the control desk, whatever that was. Soon I was in line for a vision test. I waited in rows of seats with the other recruits as people filed in, one out, to the testing room. The girl behind me, a redhead looking about 17, struck up a conversation. "You're from a small town, aren't you?" Not wanting to correct her or weigh out loud whether South Bend qualified as a small town, I just asked how she could tell. "The cowboy boots." I looked down. In fact, there were shoes I had picked up at a Filene's basement in Chicago, which slightly resembled cowboy boots if jeans were draped over them. I wasn't going to ruin our rapport, so I just nodded. "I'm from a small town, too," she quickly volunteered. "Marseilles, Illinois." I must have looked at her blankly, so she clarified. "It's close to Peru, Illinois." "We had a Peru in Indiana, too," I offered, a bit lamely. She hoped to work as a secretary in the military, and had decided to join the Army because it would pay for college. After the vision test came a colorblindness test, a blood test, a pee test. Just as I began to feel a sense of momentum moving from station to station, the line for urinalysis came to a standstill. One kid, it seemed, was unable to produce, and for reasons of security and integrity, pulling him out of sequence was out of the question. This was when I learned that there is a surefire way to make someone urinate. Chug 15 cups of warm water in quick succession. Regrettably, it may also induce vomiting. The unfortunate recruit dutifully did both, and the line began moving again. There was a breathalyzer, a doctor one-on-one, more waiting, more testing. The final exercise was in a room mysteriously called ortho-neuro. 25 at a time and stripped to our underwear, we were put through a number of exercises by a cheerful civilian and an ancient-looking, humorless doctor. Formed into two lines facing each other, we were told to swing our arms around, forward, backward, do something like jumping jacks, then something called a duck walk that involved squatting and walking at the same time, then walk on our knees, and so on through about 20 of these little routines. I began to feel like a preschooler, or like a recruit in newsreel footage from World War II, as they put us through our various motions and then told us to sit in numbered seats on benches. All of our medical folders were placed in a row of little holders on the wall, each numbered 1 through 25, just like our spots on the bench. Looking bored, the doctor examined them in no particular order. Then, in no particular order, names were called. Winters, you're qualified. Winters gets up, is handed his folder, puts his clothes back on, and walks out of the room back into the hallway, looking like he just won the lottery. McAllister, you're qualified. Lopez, Taggetts, Bowman, Perez, Buttigieg, you're qualified. Ridiculously, you feel like you have accomplished something when they tell you you're medically qualified. For this, you get to go to another waiting room. Eventually, you're called up. A man behind a desk, whom I recalled as an unpleasant presence during the vision test earlier, now seemed to be enjoying himself immensely. But it is a good thing you're in the Navy. I just wish I had someone with your name in my unit. The fun I could have. Damn guy. Then, a little more quietly, confidential and approving, you know how hard it is to get in for intel right now. Then another look at the stack of paper, and finally, you're squared away. Over subsequent weeks, more paperwork followed, including the intense vetting for the background check that goes with a top-secret clearance. Screen by screen, on a website belonging to the Office of Personnel Management, I carefully accounted for every foreign connection and trip. Every commute to Canada for McKinsey, every Maltese cousin I kept in touch with, every penny of the 50 bucks or so that I still had in a British bank account from Oxford. I ran down contact information for foreigners I had known, and told old high school and college friends not to be alarmed if someone approached them, saying they were from the FBI and wanting to know how many times they had seen me smoke pot. Not many, but more than zero. With a remarkably straight face, an investigator appeared in South Bend to meet with me, confirm some address information, and ask if I had ever attempted to overthrow the government. At last, an email arrived in September 2009, affirming that everything was ready and it was time to take the oath. Even this process bore out the military mantra of hurry up and wait, or in this case, wait and hurry up. After an excruciatingly slow process, the recruiting lieutenant insisted on getting the final signatures in by the end of the month. With my work travel schedule and her need to have me do the oath somewhere near her Detroit area base, it wasn't easy to find a time and place. I had built up a certain mental image in mind for my commissioning. If not a stirring scene like the emotional swearing-in of Richard Gere's character at the end of An Officer and a Gentleman, then at least a photogenic moment with my right hand raised and maybe a few flags in the background, something worthy of a photo that I would frame and one day show my kids. I had assumed we would do the honors on the parade ground at Naval Station Great Lakes, the major Navy facility near Chicago. Instead, the lieutenant proposed we split the difference between South Bend and Detroit and meet at a Big Boy diner in Coldwater, Michigan. But the Big Boy was closed, so we wound up at a nearby coffee shop where we went over the paperwork together one more time, and she showed me where to sign. Not big on ceremony, she added, "If you really want to raise your right hand, we can do that." 1 minute later, I was a member of the military, a commissioned officer, ensign, United States Navy Reserve. Chapter 5. Meet Pete. No one sits on his mother's knee and says he hopes one day to become a state treasurer. The truth is that I made it through my schooling and early adulthood without ever noticing the office existed, or giving any thought to what it meant. As a student, learning about the exploits of senators and governors, and wondering if I might someday hold office myself, it never crossed my mind that getting into politics would mean running for an office that most people had never heard of. Yet by the time my 28th birthday approached in early 2010, I had decided to quit my job and spend the better part of the year, and my savings, seeking an obscure office that paid less than half of what I'd already been making. It all happened because of a chance to stand up for the then unpopular rescue of the American auto industry, and because I actually knew what an empty car factory looks like. It takes great imagination to look at the broken windows and falling bricks of a decaying Studebaker factory in South Bend and picture the days when it was heaving with life and employing tens of thousands of people. It takes far less imagination to glance at today's enormous, well-kept Chrysler plants on the outskirts of Kokomo, Indiana, and picture what would happen if they were to fall silent. After about a year without maintenance, the walls would show disuse. Windows on the office side would be distressed or broken within a couple years, and by the end of the decade, 5-foot weeds would be pushing through the cracked asphalt of the massive parking lot. Anyone from South Bend knows exactly what it looks like when an industry collapses. No one wants to see it happen to anyone else, which was why I followed the news closely when the 2008 economic crisis left Chrysler on life support. I was still at McKinsey, working out of borrowed office space and hotel rooms in San Francisco, Dubai, Seattle, or Stamford, depending on the day. On paper, I was part of the Chicago office, but in practice, I worked wherever the study took me, traveling at least 4 days a week. By this point, I'd realized that it didn't much matter to my employer where I actually lived, so I had moved home to South Bend. This cut my rent in half and gave me more time with my parents, who hadn't lived in the same state as me in almost a decade. And in those rare days at home, or when I needed a break from my spreadsheets, or on a plane from somewhere to somewhere, I would pull up news articles and follow the unfolding drama of the near death and rescue of the American auto industry. I hadn't spent much time in Kokomo, but like most people from South Bend who had occasion to visit Indianapolis, I'd been through it at least a dozen times. About half the size of South Bend, the city of Kokomo was the midpoint of the 3-hour drive between home and the state capital. Every state band competition, soccer tournament, or family trip to Indy involved at least passing through the edge of town on old US 31. Coming southward, you know you're getting near the city limits when you see the Indiana Transmission Plant 2, or ITP2, on the left-hand side. From the highway, you wouldn't notice much about this white and blue building other than its sheer mass. Decades newer than the Studebaker main assembly building I knew so well in South Bend, it was made of steel rather than brick, and was one story across 61 acres rather than 6 floors. But the overall proportions are similar, with over 500,000 square feet of space. ITP2 accounts for about 2,000 jobs, and it's not even the biggest Chrysler facility in town. About 3 miles farther down the road, near the heart of the small city, you come to a stoplight and see two huge factories, one on either side. On the right is another transmission plant, with another 3,500 jobs. Across from it is a plant that now belongs to GM Components Holdings, with about 3,000 more employees. The historic heart of Kokomo, with its quaint town square and the county courthouse, is about a mile west of the highway. Directly or indirectly, nearly everything in Howard County was fueled by the auto industry. In total, the town of 56,000 had 4 Chrysler plants and 1 Delphi factory, and about 1 in 5 workers was in manufacturing. So Kokomo had a lot to lose when the Great Recession struck our country and our state, with the auto companies hit hardest. As cable news told the story in stock market charts, workers at Chrysler and Delphi saw it in layoff notices. Thousands were suddenly out of a job, and with unemployment in Kokomo in double digits, there were not a lot of other options. At least layoffs meant the possibility of coming back. Families hoped and waited for news of a callback before their savings ran out. The alternative, a total collapse of the companies, was unthinkable. It would take the whole city down, not just the factories. The area could see 40% unemployment. No business, from Applebee's to the Cone Palace, my favorite family-owned ice cream shop, would stand much of a chance. Nor would the disaster be confined to Kokomo. Even at rock bottom during the crisis, the auto industry employed 69,000 people in Indiana. South Bend's days of making Studebakers were long gone, but thousands of families in our city depended on good jobs at companies that made parts and supplies for the industry. At least we had our colleges and universities, and proximity to Chicago. If the auto industry went belly up altogether, a city like South Bend would be wounded. A town like Kokomo would be devastated. As Christmas approached, the news went from bad to worse. Having laid off 12,000 workers in 2008, Chrysler announced in December that it would halt production at all 30 of its manufacturing plants. Dangerously low on cash and headed for bankruptcy, the company seemed unlikely to survive very far into 2009. President Bush was preparing to leave office, but the emergency couldn't wait for the transition. In December, he boldly initiated a $17.4 billion bailout loan package, saying bankruptcy now would lead to a disorderly liquidation of American auto companies. To me, disorderly liquidation sounded like a cartoon whirlpool, with cars and workers waving their arms for help in the downward spiral toward the drain. A simpler way to put it was that millions of lives and hundreds of communities stood to be ruined. Yet the move to prevent this disaster was clearly not a political winner. Something about the word bailout makes voters allergic, and the Senate was loath to vote for the package. When Congress refused to authorize funds, Bush acted unilaterally, rewiring money that Congress had authorized with other purposes in mind as part of the TARP bank rescue. The new Democratic administration planned to continue the unpopular policy, but as President Obama took office in January 2009, it was clear that the funding was not enough to hold off a collapse. The new president faced an immediate choice about whether to put more cash into supporting the auto industry. The politics could not have been worse. One poll found that 72% of Americans were against further loans. Even in South Bend, many voters viewed the idea skeptically. The bank bailout had left a bad taste in our mouths, and some thought more cash into the auto rescue would just be throwing good money after bad. Bumper stickers began to appear around town with a sarcastic contribution to the debate. Bailout Studebaker. Within the White House, most of Obama's economic advisors were opposed. They didn't believe Chrysler could survive, even with the additional loans. But Obama decided to proceed anyway, adding funding while helping to broker an alliance between Chrysler and Fiat to keep it in business. And it worked. The newly formed post-bankruptcy version of Chrysler was able to crawl, then walk, then run, and eventually the company exceeded expectations for sales and growth. And the auto industry comeback helped lead the overall economic recovery of the country. By the fall of 2010, all of the laid-off workers had been called back, and unemployment started moving back to normal levels. And with remarkable speed, the government had recovered most of the taxpayer money that had gone into the deal. By 2012, this once unpopular policy had come to be seen as a clear win. Obama used it as a cudgel against his opponent, Mitt Romney, who had opined against the bailout in a 2008 op-ed entitled "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt." In 2008, that had clearly been the safe position to take. But by 2012, voters understood that bold action had been needed. The tables had turned, and now Romney was left trying to explain away his previous view. When it came to health care, Romney refused to admit that he was the true father of what came to be known as Obamacare. But when it came to the auto industry, the reverse was true. His campaign actually tried to take credit for the bailout he had once opposed. A campaign spokesman said of the structured bankruptcy, "Mitt Romney had the idea first." To be fair, Romney was making some nuanced and sensible points in his article about the need for Detroit to modernize, but events had disproven his bottom-line 2008 prediction. Quote, "If General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler get the bailout that their chief executives asked for yesterday, you can kiss the American automotive industry goodbye," end quote. I knew what South Bend had to deal with after losing just one car company. Even now, I shudder to think of what would have happened to the industrial Midwest if the entire American auto sector had been allowed to fall apart. South Bend's current renaissance would have been impossible. In fact, it's doubtful that the Great Recession would have been reversed at all. My career in elected politics, as I mentioned earlier, began in the midst of this American economic drama. What pulled me in was a weird subplot to the remarkable rescue, a lawsuit that almost stopped the Chrysler bankruptcy dead in its tracks. At work one day in the spring of 2009, I was calculating the effects of energy efficiency policies on utility balance sheets when I needed a break. The spreadsheet went into the background and I flicked through the news. An article caught my eye. Indiana pensioners object to Chrysler sale. I clicked and read the unbelievable news that the state treasurer of Indiana, Richard Murdoch, was going to sue, demanding that a judge block the bankruptcy and liquidate Chrysler instead. In other words, an elected official in Indiana was attempting to stop the president from saving the livelihoods of thousands of Indiana families. Murdoch was no household name even in Indiana, but if you followed our state's politics closely, then you could see him doing this sort of thing. There was something genial and earnest about him, but you could also read in his eyes the fixations of a fierce ideologue. Trained as a geologist, he had become a coal company executive and then a perennial candidate, trying three times, unsuccessfully, to win Southwest Indiana's congressional seat. He finally landed a commissioner position in Vandenberg County, and, after a couple other unsuccessful campaigns for different offices, managed to become treasurer in 2006. Through his many races, he established the reputation of a strong conservative, making it clear that bipartisanship was not his thing. He once told a cable news host that, quote, "bipartisanship ought to consist of Democrats coming to the Republican point of view," end quote, adding that, quote, "to me, the highlight of politics, frankly, is to inflict my opinion on someone else," end quote. You might wonder how such partisanship could possibly play into a job as technical and non-ideological as state treasurer, whose main role is to manage the state's pension funds for government employees and teachers. But someone with a deep enough ideological worldview, coupled with strong ambitions to run for something bigger, can always find a way to use an office, any office, to make a name for himself. Murdoch was a purist when it came to free markets, and therefore was totally against the idea of government playing a role in the economy. The auto bailout was a Bush-initiated program designed to hold off a possible depression, but that didn't make it any more acceptable in Murdoch's view. Even worse, the terms of the negotiated bankruptcy were favorable to the United Auto Workers, anathema to a dyed-in-the-wool conservative who viewed organized labor with contempt. Cleverly, Murdoch realized that Indiana's pension funds owned some Chrysler bonds, and reasoned that this might give him standing in court to challenge the deal. When else would an obscure state treasurer get a chance not only to assert free market principles and deal a blow to labor, but also to provoke a showdown with the hated Obama administration over a major policy priority? The temptation was irresistible, and so Murdoch went to court. The theory of his lawsuit was that the pension funds were secured creditors and should have been given better treatment when they took a loss on their holdings as part of the bankruptcy and restructuring of Chrysler. The Chrysler bonds represented less than 1% of the pension's holdings, about $17 million, but that was the legal toehold Murdoch needed in order to intervene. He hired a New York-based law firm for about $2 million and filed a lawsuit asking that the bankruptcy be halted. The stakes were enormous. If he succeeded, the entire rescue might have been prevented, pushing the company into liquidation. The company, its assets, and most importantly, the jobs, would be gone forever. On Friday, May 29, 2009, New York's federal bankruptcy court rejected the motion. Murdoch appealed. On June 5th, the appeals court also affirmed the sale, leaving Murdoch heading into the weekend with nowhere to go but all the way to the Supreme Court. He filed a request for an emergency stay on Sunday, June 7th, and the next day, the court granted a temporary stay while reviewing whether to intervene. To his original argument, Murdoch added a constitutional challenge, arguing that it was not legal to use funds from the Troubled Asset Relief Program for this purpose. Using the TARP money this way was Bush's workaround after the Senate refused to fund the auto bailout in late 2008. If found unconstitutional, it would push the entire matter back into the hands of a Congress incapable of doing anything unpopular. Until the Supreme Court could decide whether to take the case, the sale was on hold. But it couldn't wait long. The entire bailout deal had a June 15th deadline. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate in Howard County had soared to 20%. Kokomo's mayor, Greg Goodnight, braced his employees and community for the possibility that their biggest employer might never get back on its feet. Services would have to be cut, families would have to reconsider plans to send their kids to college, and the entire population of the town would begin to drain away. Obscure bankruptcy proceedings don't generally get much notice outside of the business world, but over that weekend, the country began to take notice. Murdoch was making the rounds of the cable shows, and in the process became a hero in what was just beginning to be known as the Tea Party, for standing up to government, labor, and Obama all at once. By now, Chrysler was estimated to be losing $100 million a day. One industry expert told CNN that, quote, if the case drags on for even a few weeks and Chrysler is unable to restart its plants by the end of the month as planned, it could spell doom for Chrysler, end quote. Its suppliers would be next, and the simultaneous rescue of GM might fall apart too. In a filing on Monday the 8th, Solicitor General Elena Kagan, soon to be named to the Supreme Court herself, responded for the administration, reminding the Supreme Court and the country of what was at stake. Quote, the liquidation of Chrysler would have very severe effects on the American and Canadian economies. More than 38,000 Chrysler employees would lose their jobs. 23 manufacturing facilities and 20 parts depots will be shuttered. More than 3,000 Chrysler dealers would suffer significant and possibly fatal harm to their businesses. And billions of dollars in health and pension benefits for current and former Chrysler workers would be wiped out. End quote. In addition to the economic gravity of the situation, there were serious legal flaws in Murdoch's case. The biggest was that the holdings he represented would actually be worth less under liquidation than in the proposed bailout deal. In other words, if the pensions won the lawsuit, they would actually lose money compared to the plan they were suing to stop. In general, American case law does not allow you to go to court and sue to make yourself worse off. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court denied the stay and declined to hear the case. The sale could go forward, as it did the next day. The sense of relief was still tentative. It would be years before we would know that the rescue was a success, with the companies and jobs saved and the government paid back. But the Indiana communities that rely on the auto industry, and possibly the American economy as a whole, had dodged a bullet. Murdoch himself was no worse off for his courtroom rejection. He had made a name for himself, and in his own mind, he had stood on principle by defying Washington and the auto workers who had pushed so hard to save their jobs. Gripped by ideology, Murdoch simply could not accept that government getting involved could be a good thing, even if it prevented the destruction of thousands of lives. But I wonder sometimes whether he talked to any of the families whose livelihoods could have been wrecked by his legal adventure. Did he think about the stakes for them, or was it just numbers on a page to him? To Murdoch, it seems, the most important issue at stake in the auto rescue was that investors on the bond market would have to take a haircut. To the rest of us, the most important issue was that families' lives could be ruined by the same kind of economic disaster that had nearly killed my hometown half a century earlier. To me, the whole episode was about what happens when a public official becomes obsessed with ideology and forgets that the chessboard on which he is playing out his strategy is, to a great many people, their own life story. Good policy, like good literature, takes personal lived experience as its starting point. At its best, the practice of politics is about taking steps that support people in daily life, or tearing down obstacles that get in their way. Much of the confusion and complication of ideological battles might be washed away if we held our focus on the lives that will be made better or worse by political decisions, rather than on the theoretical elegance of the policies or the character of the politicians themselves. Richard Murdoch was up for re-election in 2010, and when I investigated who was looking to run against him from the Democratic side, the answer was no one. I was surprised. I knew down-ticket races, especially for Democrats in Indiana, were thankless, difficult, and hard to recruit for. But a candidate as extreme as Murdoch seemed beatable, at least if there were a favorable national atmosphere, a flawless campaign, and a bit of luck. Surely someone would take him on, in the name of the people and communities who could have been devastated by his adventure. And if no one else was going to step up, why not me? In American political culture, you are not supposed to admit you have any interest in running for office until the moment you declare. I didn't even realize this was a particularly American quality until studying in England, where I would often meet students who made it clear they would stand for parliament at the earliest opportunity, and then did exactly that. It's hard to say where this norm of ours comes from. I'd like to think it has something to do with the premium we place on humility. There is something jarring about the idea that anyone thinks himself truly fit to perform the tremendously difficult and sensitive tasks of public office. And so putting yourself forward to do so seems immodest. Partly for this reason, a politician's account of how he or she first came to run for office is supposed to begin with a ritual mention of having been urged to do so by others, being flattered, demurring, and eventually feeling called to step forward. Later, for other offices, something like this really would happen to me, but not this time. No one was pleading with a 27-year-old management consultant to run for statewide office in Indiana as a Democrat. I just started to think about it and felt like it could make sense. Of course, I knew that this might or might not be a good idea, and that I would need to consult people who knew this world better than I. I needed to figure out how to explore the waters before giving up my job and income in order to run for statewide office. What would I have to consider? How would I gauge the odds? What steps do you even take to get prepared and underway? I contacted Jeff Harris, whom I had gotten to know while helping our nominee for governor in 2008, to get his advice. Jeff had worked for years in and around campaigns in the labor movement, and understood the state's press corps, legislature, and Democratic Party as well as anyone. I thought he might be put off by the idea that I, in my mid-20s, wanted him to help me pursue something you would normally work your way up to for years. Still, over soup at a favorite diner, I worked up the nerve to tell him what I had in mind. After watching what went on in that office, I said, I was thinking that maybe someone like me could... Do it, he interrupted. You should do it. I'll help you. He offered not only to help me think about it, but also to bring me to events where I would meet the kind of party and community leaders I would need to know in order to mount a serious campaign. Campaigning for office is enormously difficult, but in a way, it's not very complicated. You have to persuade voters to vote for you, raise money so you can reach more voters, and get other people to help you do those two things. Half the battle is name recognition, and my biggest problem was that no one had any idea who I was. My name was unfamiliar and unpronounceable. Jeff and I spent half a day just figuring out how to render it phonetically, settling on the breakdown Buddha, Judge, which was close enough and easier to remember than any other way we could think to write it down. Plus, I was 27 years old and baby-faced enough to pass for a college student. In a campaign office, I would be more likely to be taken for an intern, or perhaps a young organizer, than an actual candidate. My family had no Indiana political connections, and neither did my employer. McKinsey didn't even have an office in the state. Jeff quickly devised a way to deal with the name recognition problem, at least among party regulars. He spotted a perfect opportunity at a traditional statewide gathering of Democratic activists at the old French Lick Resort in southern Indiana, held every year in late August. Party faithful from every corner of the state, from longtime county committee officers to young volunteers, would come together for a little bit of party business and a lot of socializing. It was a captive audience. With the right strategy, we could become known to the entire party base over the course of a single weekend. Jeff prepared by printing hundreds of stickers and spray-painting dozens of old yard signs from other campaigns with a simple, stenciled, two-word message, Meet Pete. The first day of the gathering, he arrived early. Leaning on old friendships, he convinced anyone he could to wear one of the stickers. And he installed a lawn sign every few hundred feet along all the country roads, winding through rolling hills and cornfields that led to the tiny town and the big hotel. It was impossible for anyone attending the event to miss the low-budget advertising. By the time I stepped across the porch of the old restored hotel and into the bright big lobby with its old-fashioned chandeliers and mosaic floors, there was a buzz about the signs. Enough people were asking who the hell is Pete that I had an instant conversation starter when I introduced myself to the various county party chairs, labor leaders, students, state legislators, and assorted other characters who milled about the lobby and corridors. And while I may have been an unfamiliar figure, I convinced people that my business background and education could qualify me to challenge an opponent who had just made a name for himself in the worst way. Buoyed by the response at French Lick and encouragement from the state party chairman, Dan Parker, who was probably relieved that a somewhat qualified candidate was willing to try this at all, I took my message to the chicken dinners of as many county parties as we could find. If a dozen Ball State College Democrats were willing to meet, so was I. If a friend of my parents was willing to organize a house party in South Bend, I was there. A church basement in Sullivan or a one-room Farm Bureau office among the mint fields of Stark County would do fine. Any place that would let me introduce myself and talk about how important the office was. I also went around union halls, hearing firsthand what was happening to communities that had relied on auto jobs, and sensing the anger and frustration of workers who felt that their own elected officials could not be trusted to support their livelihoods. Over rubber chicken, ham and beans, chili, or sweet potato pie, I listened to stories in one town after another coming to terms with the kind of devastation that had ripped through my own city a generation before. Technically, I was still just thinking about it, but the reception at these events made me feel that I could hold my own as a candidate, and that there was a path to victory, however uphill. True, no Democrat had held this office since the 1970s, but an underfunded candidate in 2006 had come remarkably close, and Murdoch's track record meant it might be the hottest ever race for treasurer, if there was such a thing. All I had to do was quit my job. I was ready for a career change. Still, it wasn't an easy leap. Moving home to South Bend had worked wonders for my cost of living, but I still felt uneasy about living without an income for a year so that I could campaign full-time. And if I actually won, I could look forward to getting paid a fraction of what I'd be making if I stuck around the firm. But seeking this office was a chance to do something uniquely important, and something no one else seemed prepared to do. It also meant finally ignoring what the script says a well-credentialed young professional ought to do. Up to that moment, at virtually every juncture in my life, there was a powerful brand name associated with whatever I was doing. Harvard, Rhodes, McKinsey, United States Navy. When you are connected to an institution with that strong a name, people use it as a shortcut for understanding who you are. And if you're not careful, you use it as a shortcut too, taking on the shape of that name yourself over time. Contrary to every unspoken rule of my education, running for office now meant trading a stable and prestigious role for an unlikely and unheard-of effort. It was time to step out of the warm embrace of well-branded institutions, known for both nurturing and defining their people, and exchange it for the chance to build and become something new. As a single person, I had lived simply during my time at McKinsey, and had saved enough to get me through 1 year. So, other than Navy Reserve drill weekends, I was a full-time candidate for most of 2010. Jeff and I set up a simple office in the basement of the Building Trades Union Hall in South Bend, next door to the insulators and across from the painters. Like my high school, the interior of the place had a distinct feel of the 1950s, dark brown tile on the floor, and what looked like asbestos panels on the ceiling. It was also functional, close to home, and filled with likable and jocular labor organizers, and the price was right. We moved in and got to work. As with any other job, there is no better way to learn political candidacy than by doing it. An introvert by nature, I slowly became comfortable with the outgoing disciplines of campaigning. Each day brought a new lesson. Up at dawn, to shake hands at a manufacturing plant gate when the shift changed, you learned that the people coming into work were a much better audience than the ones who were leaving, tired and ready to go home. Crossing the state in a hurry to get from a parade in one county to a lunchtime function in another, you learned that car time can and should also be call time, your best chance to reach potential donors and allies during the day. Watching faces rise and fall during a dinnertime speech to, say, the Dearborn County Democratic Party at an Elks Lodge, you learned which stories would resonate where, how long to make your speech, when you had an audience in your hands, and when you were about to lose them. Sticking out your hand to introduce yourself to a stranger enjoying his pork tenderloin at a county fair, you learned that it was a lot better to start a conversation by asking about his goals than launching right into yours. The call time was the hardest. It meant reaching out to everyone you had ever known to ask if they would send you money. You have 2 minutes small talk, a quick wind-up about the state of the race, and the inevitable hard ask. So I was hoping I could count on you for a $250 contribution. Eventually, I came to prefer calling strangers to calling acquaintances, since they took less time to realize why you were calling and were more comfortable giving a yes or a no. I spent hours on this daily, and often wonder if most Americans realize this is how many elected officials spend most of their time. It's not unusual for a member of Congress to spend 20 hours a week doing this, and you have to wonder whether, like spending too much time typing or sunbathing, it does something unhealthy to you over the long run. In the car or at a desk in headquarters, I would go through page after page of calls that our finance director had prepared for me, based on lists of people who had a history of giving to Democrats. And just when I was losing hope, after an hour spent leaving 10 voicemails that I knew would never get returned, and having 3 conversations that all ended in, "Okay, let me think about it," or "I'd have to talk to my wife," someone would actually help. "Is this Charles?" I would ask. "Yeah, I go by Charlie, but yeah." "Well, my name's Pete Buttigieg, and I'm running for state treasurer. Have you followed the race much?" "Not really." "Okay, well, I'm the Democratic candidate, and we're putting together a campaign to stand up for a better way to handle our state's finances. Did you know that the Republican incumbent... I'm actually a Republican. He'd go on. But all my friends are Democrats. John says you're a good guy, so I'll write you a check. I think, really? But I say, that's great. Here's the address. In fact, more strangers said yes than I'd have expected, and friends were extraordinarily supportive once I got over the awkwardness of asking for their help. And, as with everything else, I got better at it with practice. Compared to fundraising, retail politics was a simple pleasure. Indiana has 92 counties, and we visited nearly all of them. A typical Saturday that summer would involve three or so parades, perhaps a county fair or two mixed in, and one or more appearances at a Jefferson Jackson dinner, each event usually at least an hour's drive from the next. The Jefferson Jackson dinners, or JJs, were the central ritual of campaigning within the party. A decade later, Democratic organizations would reconsider naming their annual events after these two morally problematic men, but that trend is only now penetrating throughout Indiana. Jeff and I would appear at the Elks Lodge, Legion Hall, Community Center, or in the very biggest counties, a hotel ballroom. If I was lucky, a county chair would recognize me and show me in, but usually I started at the check-in table, where a volunteer asked my name and then furrowed her eyebrows, studying a printed list as she tried to figure out how to spell my name without asking me again to say it. I'd buy a few tear-off tickets for the 50-50 raffle, go into the hall with the tables, and introduce myself to every single person. The faces would be skeptical but polite, and eventually we would all settle in over chicken and beans as the program began, the pledge, the prayer, and the speeches. The custom of working your way up to the most distinguished speaker is often reversed at a rural JJ dinner. If a congressman was present, he would usually go first, so he could leave for another event. The down-ticket statewide races typically came late in the program, somewhere after the state representatives and before the auction. I could write a book just about the food we ate. A street fair comes to mind one summer night in Evansville, a city about the size of South Bend, but on the opposite end of the state, across the river from Kentucky. At the unforgettable Westside Nut Club Fall Festival, I was met with a mostly delicious range of offerings that amounted to a cardiological nightmare. That night in my journal, I copied just a portion of the C section of a two-page guide in six-point font that spelled out alphabetically all the sins available by booth. Caramel puffs, catfish fillet sandwich, catfish nuggets, chai tea, cheese balls, cheese soup, cheese sticks, cheese quesadillas, cheese burgers, about a dozen booths listed for this one, cheesecake on a stick, cheesy fries. Walking among the booths, I don't remember seeing any chai tea, but there certainly was an abundance of cheese. I somehow avoided the featured delicacy that year, deep-fried turkey testicles, as well as the festival's well-known tradition of brain sandwiches. But you have to eat something, and I ended up sampling candied jalapenos, of which the guy from the church selling them said, "All I can tell you is they've been in this here jar since the last festival a year ago," and something called pig in the mud, which is a sort of peanut butter and bacon sandwich covered in powdered sugar. That summer, I played a small part in setting a world record, most fried chicken ever prepared in a single serving. A little geographic background is in order. There is an invisible line that goes on a northeasterly slant across the northern third of our state. North of it, the preferred fair food is pork burgers. South, it's chicken. Cross another line into the southern third of the state, and the fare is typically schnitzel, only you call it pork tenderloin. If you're going to use ethnic meat names, you'd better know what you're doing. Once, in South Bend, I saw a visiting politician from a German-settled downstate city take the mic at a sausage-intensive Polish festival and make the mistake of praising the bratwurst instead of the kielbasa, and the air went out of the room for a second. I'll spare you the deeper nuances to this fair food geography. The important thing is that Franklin County is in chicken territory, and people there had been looking for a way to make the canoe festival more exciting that year. So they decided to get their community into the record books by filling a canoe with the most chicken ever placed into a single container. The previous world record was held by some KFC distributor in the Persian Gulf who had put 1,200 pounds of chicken on a giant hummus plate a few years earlier. In the glint of the evening summer sun, we gathered near the county seat, Brookville, population 2,596. The atmosphere was somewhere between jolly and crazed. I met a Colonel Sanders impersonator who pointed out that the colonel had actually been born in Indiana, not Kentucky. Signs saying things like, "Make chicken, not war," and "Beat Kuwait," ringed the canoe, while people streamed in from every corner of town, bearing styrofoam coolers full of fried chicken from restaurants and family kitchens. Eager to please, I'd tried to make myself useful by carrying a few coolers from a staging area to the boat, where the chicken was promptly dumped in. When the president of the Canoe Fest Friars Club announced the official weight of the chicken, 1,645 pounds, the applause heralded an authentically achieved moment in the life of the community. Then, of course, we ate it all. Some of the rural counties blurred together, others you can't forget, like Crawford County, where a faithful intern and I pulled up to what we thought was the county courthouse in a town called English and found no one there at all. Nolan, the intern, was as confused as I was. After dutifully following the GPS device, we stepped out of my tungsten green Taurus into the steamy air and overgrown grass and looked, blinking through the midday glare, at the brick and cinder block courthouse. The parking lot was empty. The building was locked, and on closer inspection, definitely abandoned. We looked for signs of life nearby and found no one. Not only was the courthouse empty, but the whole town was literally deserted. It turns out that was the old courthouse, before a series of floods prompted the town council to relocate not just the courthouse, but the entire town. Thus, there was Old English and New English, and we were in the wrong English. By the time we sorted it out and got uphill to New English, we had missed our appointment with Jerry Brewer, the local Democratic chair who was supposed to meet me there. Crawford County being pretty small, the lady in the clerk's office who saw me looking for him told me we could just call him at home. She dialed the phone on her desk and held out the handset for me to take as it rang. When he answered, he told me he wasn't going to be able to leave his farm that day anyway, because the harvest was coming early, and they had to pull up the corn as quickly as possible. Assuming this meant our meeting was canceled, I was about to say goodbye when he explained that we could still meet, as long as I didn't mind taking the meeting in the cab of his tractor while we did a few rows of corn. So that's where we met. In the middle of the field under an August sun, it felt in the air-conditioned cab like we were in some kind of vessel, gliding over the top of the corn as though sailing in an infinite sea of tasseled ears and husks. In front of us, the machinery calmly devoured 6, maybe 12 rows at a time. At one point, we came to a sort of clearing in the vast cornfield and stopped to talk to the farmhand, a bearded, tattooed, burly man whose eyes looked somehow too young to belong to someone as bearded, tattooed, and burly as he was. He was fresh back from serving in Iraq, Jerry said, and was helping in the fields for the summer. We got out of the tractor while Jerry and his employee did something involving a trailer hitch that I did not fully understand, and then we were back on our way, leaving the young man doing whatever he was doing out there, as we kept on a straight path along the rows toward the tree line in the distance. You can read the progress of the campaign calendar in the condition of the corn. After you announce and begin campaigning in the early spring, you drive between great squares of rich black soil, freshly turned up, with innocent two-leaf sprigs ornamenting the earth geometrically with dots of green. Then the stalks grow into fair and parade season, well past knee-high by 4th of July, if all goes well. When you can't see over the top of the corn, such things as corn mazes become possible, and it's almost back to school. Harvest means it's right around Labor Day, and by now you also have at least a rough sense of what kind of year it's going to be for your party. You're in the home stretch when the harvest is over, and you can again see across the fields over the tops of the chopped-off stalks. Rumbling through them in the passenger seat of Jeff's hybrid Saturn SUV, I would think of the 19th-century Hoosier dialect poet James Whitcomb Riley. The stubble in the furries kind of lonesome-like but still, a-preaching sermons to us of the barns they growed to fill. If it was too early or late to call someone, I might listen to Lyle Lovett's Up in Indiana, and thumb through news stories on my iPhone, seeing more and more evidence that this would not be a good year for Democrats, in our state or anywhere else. Democratic members of Congress were still licking their wounds from the tongue-lashings they got in town halls across America over the summer of Tea Party rage, heaped with abuse from voters who had been led to believe that the health care bill amounted to red socialism, complete with death panels and all manner of evil. Conservatives were energized in ways not seen since the early Bill Clinton administration, and the makings of a wave were underway. This was not good news for me. In a state like ours, a down-ticket Democrat stood a chance of winning only under the best of circumstances, and these were clearly not going to be the best of circumstances. In the final days, the obscurity of our race added to a sense of doom. We had gotten some good press coverage, and my fundraising events and phone calls had even yielded enough money to do a few TV ads, rare for a campaign like this. But outside of party activists, organized auto workers, and public finance wonks, most voters had still never heard of me. On November 1st, the day before the election,